This is the IBJ podcast for the week of July 20th, 2020, brought to you by the law firm Craig DeVault. I'm Mason King.
Whether we head to second wave or not depends on the residents of Marion County. We can't do it alone. We can make the best recommendation, but it depends on whether the individuals in Indianapolis want to go back to stay in shelter in place. If they don't want to go back and go backwards, then please listen very carefully. Please follow our recommendations.
Dr. Virginia Kane has been in charge of the Marin County Public Health Department since 1994. And over her tenure, she has fought waves of public health crises, including HIV and AIDS, the H1N1 pandemic in 2009, and the ongoing scourge of Black infant mortality. But never has she taken such a visible and constant public role of authority as she has over the last 5 months of the coronavirus crisis. For Indianapolis, she is one of the key interpreters of data, prime shapers of policy, and chief evangelizers for protective measures. And as I'm sure we can all appreciate, this is an immensely complicated job that requires recalibrating strategy on an almost daily basis. And virtually every aspect of our lives is affected, from whether we go to work or whether our kids go to school, to how much social distancing is warranted, and when and where we should wear masks, just to name a few things. IBJ reporter Lindsay Aridoti interviewed Dr. Kane last week about the frustrations and challenges of tackling the pandemic. She addresses the current states of local testing and contact tracing. She explains the reasoning behind the recent mask mandate and when it will be possible to make a call on holding the Indianapolis 500. And she has an emphatic message for Marin County residents who might not see the wisdom of following public health recommendations. Here's their interview.
Thank you so much for taking some time to chat with me today. Obviously, you are a busy person right now.
Yes, believe me, how many calls I'm getting from left and right.
I'm sure.
That's a statement, unfortunately.
So what's been your biggest frustration or biggest challenge in responding to this?
What I will tell you is, one is for us, it's always about the science and the data in terms of making major decisions, and it's a balancing act when you make these decisions, because we have to remember we are an urban environment compared to other places, and our population density is a lot greater. So how do you communicate and get the message about what needs to be done in order to make our community and our environment safe? So I think that's been a major challenge for us. I think the second challenge for us that was very frustrating was not having enough personal protective equipment that we thought we would have at the start of this epidemic. And the third greatest issue for us was not having the availability to do the necessary testing in order to curtail our outbreak. I'm having pockets of individuals that might be infected, but not having the wide availability of testing until sort of almost a month into the epidemic. So those kind of things really hamper your responsive effort. And then the fourth thing was we have to be very concerned about our vulnerable populations. And so our folks who were homeless, individuals who were incarcerated and in confined places, we needed to make those recommendations in terms of social distancing and other measures in order to protect them. So I got, as a health department, I got in the homeless business where we were trying to find motels, hotel locations in order to house our homeless populations. We had to make the arrangements for their food, taking care of them and a lot of their other needs that they might have. We couldn't let shelters that are housing, 500 to 700 people all be in one location, because if you had an infected person and in those very close quarters, you would have a major outbreak. So that was a new business for us. But I also have to single out Dr. Jennifer Sullivan from the Division of Family and Social Services, because they made a special hotel available for us to house our positive homeless and any other individuals who didn't have a place to quarantine. And I know that that was manned by Ashkenazi Hospital and their staff from the mental health wing. So kudos, keep up that good work.
Is that the homeless shelter that you guys were using that hotel for? Are you guys still doing that?
So let me just say this. So that was a shelter that was set up by the Division of Family Social Services, but the Marion County Health Department had set up a hotel as well, also working with the City of Indianapolis under Jeff Bennett, Deputy Mayor. We set up three also individual shelters manned by my staff. We used two of the city parks, gymnasiums to house individuals. Cindy Holbrook at the Indiana State Fairgrounds was gracious enough to let us have another site at the fairgrounds where we set up our first COVID-19 testing for essential workers at that site, but we also had a fantastic shelter for the homeless also at that shelter. So just so many partners that have worked so closely with us, I think that has been huge. And the folks who were incarcerated are always a major concern in making sure we had testing available and resources to help provide the medical services for our correctional facilities and giving them guidance about what they should do and not do. So looking at things from that nature, having to give recommendations such as closing our schools based on our data. So a lot of tough decisions to be made. And we got in the business of doing drive-through testing, which we had not done before and didn't have the level of expertise, but we quickly learned how to get that to happen in order to provide more testing as more collection kits were available.
I want to go back to one of the challenges you mentioned, which was not having enough PPE and testing available in the beginning. Do you feel like there is enough PPE available now? Do you feel like we're getting to do enough testing now? Is it as widely available as it should be?
So right now we currently have over 21 sites in Marion County that are providing testing. We can always improve on our testing, hands down, even with 21 sites. I would love for us to get to the point where we're doing what's called point of care testing. What do I mean by that? I can do a test on you and I've got the results in 30 minutes. It makes us way more efficient. I don't have to sit there and wait for days to get my results. It would help us tremendously in our contact tracing. So we are waiting for that first point of care testing, where you can do it right into a doctor's office or a clinic or even in our drive-throughs, so that they're getting their results within 30 minutes would be humongous. And so that's the piece where I think we're lacking right now. There's some tests on the market waiting to be approved by the FDA. I think Roche Diagnostics is waiting to hear some good news, and we want them to hear some good news. And so he's added to this puzzle that could provide us huge dividends in terms of helping with the outbreak and communicating and getting the people who need to be tested. So we have tried to go to a number of our hotspots throughout Marion County, trying to make it more convenient for individuals to come to our sites and get tested. And of course, we offer free testing. Secondly, we have a significant number of our population that they don't have a primary care provider. And so a lot of, some of our testing site requires a doctor's order. But the sites that are run by the Marion County Public Health Department, you don't have to have a doctor's order. I'm your doctor. So you can come and get tested.
With the rise in cases that we've seen over the past couple weeks, does that indicate that we're reopening too quickly, you know, not just in Marion County, but across the state?
So let me just tell you, I'll talk first a little bit about Marion County, because that's the one that I know about the best. We have started to see a slight increase in our cases in Marion County. But looking at it from an average, we've gone like 2 weeks ago, we were averaging about 57 cases per day, and we've gone now to 65 cases per day. And we kind of expected this to happen a little bit, so it's not significantly high, but when you had the 4th of July and we opened up some more businesses, we thought we'd see a slight increase of cases. But when we look at what we consider our positivity rate, these are the percentage of people when they're tested, you have a positive test. And when we were at the peak of our cases, where we were averaging over 300 cases a day, and that occurred in the last week of April and the first week of May, our positivity rate was as high as 45%. So we have come down substantially in our last numbers. I believe looking at our positivity rate as of July the 12th was at about 7.4%. Now, other indicators we look at too is we look at our hospitalization rates. Have we seen an increase in hospitalization? And we have dropped down significantly. We have seen plenty of space in our intensive care units, our hospital beds, and so we feel really good about that. As we have seen our cases increase a little bit, we've seen some of our emergency room visits increase, but never more than 5 cases in a day from a 7-day average related to our emergency room visits and our new cases. But our deaths have dropped dramatically. Last week, we had a number of days that had no deaths related at all. But we are seeing a different trend now in who's impacted by this COVID-19 cases. So we're now seeing a younger generation. So for those individuals who are 20 to 50 years of age, is now where we're seeing the majority of our cases compared to at the start of this epidemic when it was primarily senior.
Why do you think that is?
Because I think, you know, when you stay in shelter, it's so hard and very difficult because it was a new way of life that we've never done it before. And so as you reopen your different phases of this epidemic, you know, a lot of our younger generation are, you know, our college students, people in their 20s and their 30s, you know, they first heard the message, well, it's only happening in our seniors. So they have this fierceness perception, well, it's not happening to me, so I'm not going to be worried about this. And so now we're having to change our message to say, no, it is now occurring in a younger population. I need you to do the social distancing, and I need you to wear that mask. And please, please, please do your personal hygiene by doing frequent hand washing and be very careful what you are. But some of our citizens believe that they are invincible, so they have less concern related to that. Now, one of the unique things about this whole epidemic is we have not seen as much infections occurring in our younger children. So less than 5% of all of our cases are in individuals 0 to 19, about 5%. So 95% are in different age groups. So we're trying to figure out although they can contract it, why they don't appear to be as vulnerable compared to our older population. So that's something that we're trying to look at very, very carefully.
All right, let's take a quick break from the discussion to hear from our sponsor. You're listening to the IBJ Podcast.
The IBJ Podcast is brought to you by Krieg DeVault, a trusted and dynamic law firm representing a wide variety of local, regional, and national clients. Committed to each other and to every client, Krieg DeVault prides itself on integrity, professionalism, respect, and excellence. Financial institutions, global manufacturers, national healthcare providers, and successful organizations of all sizes and market focus rely on Krieg DeVault to create innovative and successful business solutions. Connect today at www.kriegdevault.com.
Okay, we're back with this week's edition of the IBJ Podcast. We're listening in to an interview of Marion County Public Health Department Director Dr. Virginia Kane as IBJ's Lindsay Aridoti asks her about the different messages the public receives from local leaders about the best ways to address the coronavirus crisis.
So when it comes to reopening, but also maintaining social distancing, it almost seems like there are two different messages that people are hearing. You know, go out and support your restaurants and retailers now that they're open. Businesses need support. But at the same time, you know, don't be in a crowd with people and social distance and wear a mask. And so I'm curious what you would tell someone in terms of how do you balance those things?
So it's actually not two different messages. So even when you're going to the restaurant, we're asking inside room dining, those restaurant tables have to be 6 feet apart. It's not if you're not going back to the old regime of how we interacted in our restaurants. We also are no higher than a 75% capacity in those restaurants. And for the bars, we're going to monitor that very carefully. Right now, it's at 50% capacity. But we have to be very concerned about, you know, whether people are following our mandate about wearing masks unless they're eating or drinking, but we need to have the social distancing.
So to you, both of those messages can kind of work together, it seems like.
Yes, I believe that they can definitely work together. You know, initially, we only required just the employees and the staff to wear masks, and it recommended for the patrons. But, you know, we've looked to see what's happened across the country, like Florida, Texas, and some of those other states, and so on, abundance of caution. We need to have people understand the importance of this message, and so we move forward to make it a requirement for everybody in the public, 2 years and older, while they're outdoors in the public, if they cannot do social distancing. And I want to remind people, and people don't understand this, but a lot of those states that we're seeing, like Florida and Ohio, a number of those states reopen in their phases prior to meeting the criteria and the guidelines set out by the White House, set out by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, as well as set out by the NIH. So one of the things we've always been very careful about in Marion County because of our population density is to look at the science and try to make our decision making based on the data. But make no doubt about this. This disease is evolving. We're learning as we go along. And that's why we monitor what's the situation, not only on a daily basis. We're concerned about what's happening in so many sectors. Take, for example, the business sector. So with all of our children, if they were all doing e-learning, what happens to those parents who need to work? I may be a single parent. And if I don't work, our stimulus dollars are going to end July the 26th, unless we can get Congress to sign another stimulus package. But either I have to work, or how do I put food on my table? How am I going to pay my rent? I want to commend Chamber of Commerce and the business sector to try to find additional funding to help individuals out so they don't end up being homeless trying to educate their kids. But we have to have a balancing act here and look at all of the concerns and try to figure out how to address it in the safest and most protective manner for our community.
One of the big events that's on the horizon is the Indy 500 in August. So what are your thoughts on that right now? Is it going to be safe to have that run with fans in the stands, even if it's at 50% capacity?
So I can honestly say I don't have the answer to date, okay? It is too early for us to make that decision. We're going to have to make it closer to the event, and we're going to need to see at least two more weeks of data in order to say it is safe for us to have that event in August. We're hopeful. We have reviewed their plans on a regular basis. I know not only our local community with the mayor's office and our health department and others, but I know that the governor's folks are looking at this very carefully. And so we really have to monitor our numbers. And we have to do a national surveillance too as well, because we have to be conscious of who may be coming outside the state into our community. So there are a lot of factors that we're going to have to look at very carefully. So trying to get a lot of expertise around these large events. And so hopefully I may have an answer for you in maybe 2 weeks or so.
One of the decisions, you know, that you and Mayor Hogsett came to recently was the, and you've referenced it already, was the mask mandate. And, you know, it's been in effect for several days now. And so I'm curious if you've noticed a difference. Do you think more people are taking it seriously now? Is it having an impact?
So I definitely think it's making a difference. And we can tell that based on the businesses that are calling us, the events that are interacting with us, having events and telling us what they're putting in place and what their requirement is for people to participate in their events. So definitely we've seen a upswing in the number of people who are wearing masks. But of course, I have also seen individuals who have not worn masks. And so sometimes the difficulty lies that you can have a medical condition that might prohibit you from wearing a mask, especially if you have some respiratory difficulties related to that. So we have to be a little bit cautious that when we're seeing someone not wearing a mask, they may have a legitimate medical reasoning for why they're not wearing a mask. But what we don't want to see, what I think they saw in Michigan and Florida, where you're seeing large numbers of individuals not doing social distancing and not wearing masks. That's how you get an outbreak or a second wave of cases if we continue to let that happen.
Do you think we're headed towards a second wave?
Whether we head to second wave or not depends on the residents of Marion County. We can't do it alone. We can make the best recommendation, but it depends on whether the individuals in Indianapolis want to go back to stay in shelter in place. If they don't want to go back and go backwards, then please listen very carefully. Please follow our recommendations. Help to encourage your family members, your colleagues, any other people that you might have influence on, and take us very, very seriously. And you may not care about yourself, but we hope that you care about your loved ones. We hope that you care about your colleagues, even if you don't care about yourself. Think about them. I've been so impressed so far with the community in Indianapolis. It just seems like people stepped up and gone to that next level. I think that's why we've been so successful so far with our numbers, but we gotta be tough. You gotta hang on. You gotta be passionate. And hey, we could be the most successful story in this country based on how we respond as a community. So please help us out. Do the right thing. Be patriotic.
I know one of the things that's been talked about for a while in terms of helping contain the virus is the need for contact tracing. So from your viewpoint, how do you think that's been going?
So we've been doing a fairly decent job with contact tracing, but we definitely need to up our game related to that. We have calculated that we need at least 300 contact tracers minimum in our community to really address individuals that are provided to us in terms of who's positive. But there's several secrets to the contact tracing. That means is that we need to be able to get the results in a fairly decent time so that we can institute an investigation, making good recommendations to those individuals, interviewing them who they may have been in contact with the past 14 days when they were testing positive, and hoping that they are self-quarantining and that they're following our recommendations. So currently right now, I know that the State Department of Health has about 500 contact tracers. I think that when you look at us from the Marion County Health Department, we have about 75, and we're hoping to bump that up really, really quickly. And we know that there's at least probably about, of the 500 contact tracers, probably at least 200 of them are being devoted to Marion County.
And so those 75 that you mentioned are in addition to the state's 500?
Yes, those are the Marion County Public Health Department. But we are given a subcontract for the overall operations for contact tracing to the Fairbanks School of Public Health under Paul Havison, who were subcontracted in terms of helping to supervise and coordinate those efforts on behalf of the city of Indianapolis. But we've been doing contact tracing since the epidemic started. And so, but when you're having 300 cases per day, with that kind of manpower, I didn't have the manpower in order to respond to do contact tracing for over 300 a day. But as we are lowering it down to like 65 cases a day, we have that capability now. And we're hoping that we'll get the numbers down even lower. And our goal is we'd love to be able to reduce our average number of cases below 25 or 20.
Do you think that's possible to hit that level?
We're hoping so. So, you know, We got to worry about our younger generation and hoping that they are much smarter than the kids out of state. And so, you know, people see their friends coming back. They're coming to colleges and, some belong to fraternities or sororities or different activities. So it's going to be huge for our colleges provide the communication and education to our students. But just on a recent call that we had this week, our academic institutions are doing a bang-up job. And I'm very impressed with the plans that many of them have in place in order to help do the communication. And they're also going to be doing contact tracing on their campuses, working hand-in-hand with our local health department for the city of Indianapolis.
I think those were all the questions I had, unless there's anything else that you wanted to mention or think our readers should know.
Just know that we are working hand in hand with our school systems, whether it's charter schools, private schools, or the township schools. And we put our school guidelines out a week ago. And if any child or staff person or employee is positive for coronavirus, they're required to report that to us in 24 hours. We will provide a response recovery team and technical expertise from our nursing staff, as well as physicians that I have on board to help provide guidance to those schools, help to address communications to the parents, and help to do contact tracing investigations related to those cases. So know that we've been working very hard related to our plan and our communications with all of our school systems. You know, it's a personal choice by that parent in terms of whether they want their children to return to school in person, and I understand that. So we want to provide choices, flexibility, and to know that we value all of you. So the children, the staff in these schools, the teachers in these schools. And so we just look to hopefully continue to monitor the situation. We will like to continue to go in the right direction, but if we should go in a direction that makes us very uncomfortable, we won't hesitate to have schools close based on our data.
My thanks again to Dr. Virginia Kane and Lindsay Erdody. You can see highlights from their interview, including answers to some questions that we didn't have time to include here, in the latest issue of IBJ. And there are a few other stories I'd like to draw to your attention. On the front page, you'll see that although the city's $575 million criminal justice center project appears to be on track to meet goals for hiring minority contractors, advocates say the goals should be higher given the national focus on economic equity. Sam Quinn sheds light on the efforts to attract and support minority contractors. Also in this week's issue, Kurt Christian reports that a developer has hit pause on an ambitious project to add apartments, offices, and a hotel to Carmel's Clay Terrace Shopping Center. And Nikki Shuey sorts through the mess of debt left by retail developer Craig Johnson when he committed suicide in May. Again, you can see these stories in the print edition of IBJ or online at ibj.com. I will say that it is quite a bit easier to get access to all of IBJ's actionable, award-winning business content if you have a subscription. It works out to about $2 per week, so come on, let's get serious. That's a pretty solid investment. Just go to ibj.com and click on the subscribe button. Thanks again for making time this week for the IBJ podcast. I'm Mason King. Hang in there, everybody. We'll be back again next week.